Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 27, Feedback 3, The Search for Listeners.
The purpose of Shortbox Showcase is to talk about topics and comics that fall outside of our respective solo shows.
Now, we've not had the chance to cover feedback in the last two episodes, as we were talking about Identity Crisis, and then we had Michael Bradley as a guest on the show. So the email has been piling up, and we're going to go through it all in this episode. In advance, our great thanks to all the feedbackers and all the listeners.
Yeah, and all of the listeners specifically who will listen through this episode, which is probably going to crack almost an hour.
Some of our listeners were pretty long-winded. It just depends how long-winded we are in reply.
Exactly.
We say that in love.
Yes, and deep respect and admiration.
That is true.
Speaking of respect and admiration, our first email is from Noel Thingvall, who has been leaving us feedback on some of our earlier episodes, specifically reboots and retcons. Despite being the pro-remakes guy, I'm not always a fan of reboots.
Now here Noel is referring to his stand on the film podcast, I Hate Love Remakes. And, you know, he mentions that they have a saying on that show that no matter how bad a remake is, it doesn't make the original go away.
Right. Whereas with reboots, that's actually kind of what they do. With stuff like the New 52 in particular, it takes titles that people are still reading and invested in and junks them for the new thing that not everyone was actually asking for. I'm fine with things like the Ultimates line, but I've never been a fan of getting rid of the old stuff for no good reason. That said, I'm with Emily and still enjoying glimpses into alternate versions, either through What Ifs or Elseworlds. Neat stuff can be explored there, but the stuff that's still running doesn't have to die in order to do so.
He also commented on our Underread Comics episode number 22.
One of my favorite Underread comics is the 70s Marvel book, The Human Fly. It was a predecessor of sorts to Dazzler, in that they wanted to hire a real person, a stuntman in this case, pop star in the other, to take on the identity of the hero so as to promote the book in broader markets. It was a really fun, quietly clever, and very entertaining book, and is one of the reasons Mantlow became the go-to guy for adapting odd licensed work that nobody else could figure out. Sadly, I believe the contracts make this yet another Mantlow title that will never be brought back into print anytime soon.
Yeah, I've talked about Bill Mantlow a number of times over on the Quarterbin in reference to Rom and the Micronauts, and as Noel says, the licensing issues are just too complex and complicated at this point for those properties to even be reprinted, much less turned into movies, which, like I talked about with Scott Gardner, would be awesome. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy 4, when they run into Rom and the Space Knights, would be wonderful and seems impossible.
Yes. This is why fanfic exists. I'm being serious.
We need fan films.
YouTube, get on this.
I did want to point out that Ben Avery is covering The Human Fly as part of the Comic Book Time Machine network of podcast shows. New listener Andy Capellish also gave us some feedback about an old episode, episode 16. Just got done listening to your Sidekicks episode. Great list. I, too, am a fan of Sky High. You know, Andy always seemed like a pretty smart guy.
Oh, yeah. He's got his head on straight.
I'm so much of a fan that I chose to keep a flyer that I received in the mail from Family Video. It's the closest thing I'll ever get to a poster. Hashtag hero support. Hashtag war and peace. Hashtag terrible job at Photoshop.
That is a great movie. Like, we should rewatch that. It was actually hysterical. Like, 2 days ago, someone posted something on my Tumblr. And was a screenshot from that of our main characters and said, wow, Captain America 3 is looking pretty great. I'm like, oh my gosh, it is! It's the all-American blonde boy and his hot red-headed ass-kicker of a pseudo-girlfriend, his black best friend, and his anti-hero, brooding, long-haired buddy.
See, I think there's a connection between the role that Danielle Panabaker plays there and her role in Flash. Somehow. We need to get Mike Bailey on this, because he's connecting everything.
No, so what you're saying is that they've taken the name of Killer Frost, but she's actually going to be Poison Ivy.
Oh.
No, wait, can of worms. Wait, wait. Can of worms. Can of worms.
Later.
Later.
We'll talk about TV stuff later.
We also heard from Daniel Butcher on episodes 18 and 19. Daniel is another one of the members at the Comic Book Time Machine Network, as well as Welcome to Level 7. He says, the Relatively Geeky Network has officially bolstered commerce by encouraging me to buy a copy of The Kents. Good job. I'm a huge John Ostrander fan, but have never read this tale. I continue to be impressed in how well Ostrander uses real history in fiction. For nearly a decade, I lived in Kansas and talked about Bleeding Kansas in history courses I taught with a visit to the first territorial capital. And many of the towns that Ostrander uses are ones I have visited and passed on drives through the Midwest. So thank you all for introducing me to this story.
You're welcome, Daniel. Glad to have helped sell a copy of the book.
I think that's just my goal in life, is just to see how many copies of The Kents I can shill. Because I've almost convinced two or three other people to pick up copies. They're just...
Nice, nice. And I don't know if we've mentioned this before, but if you're not a friend of John Ostrander on Facebook...
You should be.
You should be. Especially if you like comic book things.
And cats.
And cats.
Lots of cats.
Which is what we like.
Yes.
So it kind of works out for us. Now, we've covered feedback from the Superhero Pros episode before, but we did get some additional feedback from our good buddy Luke Giaconetti from Earth Destruction Directive, the occasional Hutu Freaks, and Long Play, and the Vault of, let's just say the Vault, all on the Two True Freaks Network.
Great topic. At the used bookstores I frequent, there are quite a bit of adaptations and novelizations in the licensed sci-fi sections. I have a very guilty pleasure in licensed superhero fiction, the Iron Man novel Operation AIM by Greg Cox in particular. Not great literature by any stretch, but for an Iron fan like me, it's a hoot. But there's one element of superhero prose which you guys did not touch on. Game books. Think of them as choose-your-own-adventure type books, possibly with a little bit of dice rolling and other randomness. TSR did a series of Marvel superhero game books, as well as a series of one-on-one books, where two readers would each play one of the characters using their own game book. My brother had one of these sets, The King Takes a Dare, featuring Daredevil and the Kingpin. And while it's a very quiet sort of head-to-head game, it's interesting to run through them.
I have barely any idea what Luke is talking about here, but I guess it sounds cool.
It does. I'm intrigued by this. I've been meaning to get more into superhero gaming, because I like my Pathfinder, I like my D&D, and I like my comics. Peanut butter? Chocolate? These should be combined a little bit more in my daily life.
I think our buddy Shag has done an episode or two regarding the DC role-playing games, or one of the DC role-playing games, over at the Fire and Water podcast.
Mm-hmm. Teaming up with Gene Hendricks at least once.
I think that's right.
To talk about that sort of stuff.
I think that's right. Luke continues.
Your discussion of what genre superhero is a subgenre of got me thinking. What about heroes that don't have any special powers, such as Batman, Black Widow, or the Punisher? Wouldn't they fall more under the banner of action adventure more than sci-fi fantasy? Really, is there much of a difference between, say, Batman and Remo Williams, or between Black Widow and James Bond? So I tend to agree with Emily that tone is crucial in determining what genre a superhero story fits into. Case in point, my good friend Bob Hansen wrote a pair of action-adventure books featuring superpowered characters with code names and massive battles, Agony of the Feet and The Mass Media Massacre.
Agony of the Feet. I see what he did there.
So on the surface, they might sound like superheroics, but ultimately are superhero comedies.
Oh.
I mean, one of the bad guys is an evil meteorologist named Leslie Weatherman, for crying out loud. Anyway, great episode and lots of food for thought.
But I think he was a bit redundant when he said evil meteorologist.
Yeah.
That one's for Kirk Green.
Nice. I love thinking about where superheroes fit in, because you can do so much with just the concept of superhero. And there are so many different kinds of superheroes that really, what is there in common between, say, Zatanna and Batman and the Spectre or the Punisher or Iron Fist? Like, there's so many types of characters and types of stories that you can tell in superhero that we're actually going to throw this all in a can of worms and we'll deal with this in the future. I think it is worth discussing at much more length than we can do in this already very lengthy episode.
So next up is the boatload of feedback we got about episode 24 on canon and fandom. And I have to say that the image I used for that episode on our blog and on Facebook, I thought was a generic stack of Star Wars books from the internet. It was actually an image from the Irredeemable Shag's Star Wars book collection from his blog, Once Upon a Geek. After he informed me of that via his attorneys, I replied, "Oh, of course it was Shag. Shag is the king of search engine optimization, after all."
And oh, what that photo spawned. All of the rest of our friends apparently feeling ignored, overlooked, since we were just showing off Shag's books, felt the need to send us shelf porn. Pages and pages and pages of pictures of their shelves.
Okay, friends, you're all geeks. We know that, okay? Come on.
So much nerd cred, so much nerd shame. It was a real event.
It
was glorious. It's taught me that I need more bookshelves.
That is not what it should have taught you.
I know. I know. So, quick shout outs to all of the people who inundated us with their awesome comics collections. In particular, Scott Rifen, Michael Bailey, Andy Leyland, the Irredeemable Shag, again, Dave Attenbury, and Tom Panarese.
But on to specific comments on that episode. More from Andy Kapelish. Love the canon episode. I hate 90% of the Star Wars EU. My take was, you're darn right Chewie ain't dead. Look forward to exploring earlier episodes. And, you know, I emailed Andy back and said, you know, we welcome his feedback on early episodes or on whatever else he wants to comment on. And then, unfortunately, we got this from him. Cool beans, I'm going to shoot you guys an email about my Dengar and Lobot are actually Goofus and Gallant in space. I mean, that's my headcanon. I will provide zero evidence. You know, the purest sort of headcanon.
Okay. Maybe we open the floodgates a little bit wide on that one.
Yeah, Andy, you really don't need to send us every single comment that pops into your head. I mean, am I discouraging feedback?
Jason Trenner said that he loved the talk on canon and where the fans fit in. Of course, Jason, otherwise known as Fanboy of Miss Prime, was there to tie this into the Transformers.
Now, to be fair, he ties everything to the Transformers.
How the Transformers canon is dealt with is pretty interesting. Basically, it all happened somewhere in the multiverse. Everything counts. And holy crap, does that mean there are a lot of parallel realities?
I love this solution.
Exactly.
Now, you don't have to go and identify Earth 2, Earth Z, Earth 616,
Planet
Earth 3,
Bob.
Planet Bob.
Just so long as it happened somewhere.
That it all counts, that works perfectly for me. I love that solution.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Back to Noel. As with continuity and reboots, canon also isn't something that bothers me as long as I get a good story. I don't usually lock myself into, this is how it must be, and I'm able to juggle multiple canons at a time. I'm more interested in studying the branching of their coexistence than just wrapping my arms around a select few and brushing off all the others. And I think that's pretty much where we are, too.
Mm-hmm.
Continuity matters, but it isn't the only thing that matters. I would say, certainly for me, I think Emily's pretty close to that,
yeah,
that camp as well. And then Noel concludes with another sentiment that we can certainly relate to.
As long as none of them are written by Grant Morrison, who I not only dislike, but who has actually driven me to anger at times. Smiley face.
I don't think you're supposed to read the smiley face.
No, but it's important, because, you know, he's from the upper Midwest, and even when he's angry, he's nice angry.
That's fair.
Neil Stanifer, a.k.a. Grammar Merchant, said he really enjoyed our reflections on canon. I'm pleased that you let yourselves roam around in geekdom instead of staying confined to comics. I had never heard the terms headcanon, fan canon, or fan theory, but they make perfect sense and accord well with my own experience. I began reading comics back when the comics you got were whatever you could find at the spinner rack at your local Handy Mart or on the shelves of the liquor store. Collecting an unbroken run of any given title was unthinkable, so I quickly developed an enduring fondness for the kind of story that wouldn't leave me high and dry if I missed an issue. I picked up all the horror, combat, and western comics I could lay my hands on, and I appreciated the self-contained beauty of a DC Comics Presents, a Marvel Premiere, or a Superman Family.
Again, just to talk about what I've been doing on the Quarterbin podcast, I have developed a love for that kind of story as well. I definitely grab those team-up issues or other clear one-and-dones, one-shot issues. They are perfect for the type of story you want to read from 25 years ago, where you can pick up individual issues. You don't have to worry about the run. You don't have to sit down and read the whole thing. It wasn't designed for you to sit down and read the whole thing. There's something really exciting about those one and done types of stories.
Yeah, and not feeling like you've missed out or you need to go and track down. Not having that sort of collector's obligation.
Right.
That you grabbed six random issues of whatever, and now you have to buy the other 93 to figure out how the story all fits together.
Right, right. Now, Neil also makes the shocking confession that he even bought copies of Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen.
He's allowed to like books that I don't like. We're nuanced and stuff. I'm just going to continue insulting them. And that's okay.
You know, you're really hurting Michael Bradley's feelings now. Even though he's not even on the show.
I know! I love people who read Jimmy Olsen. I just hate Jimmy Olsen. There's a difference.
What Neil said was that these comics could be picked up, read, and put down in a sitting. And if they stank, well, the next one might be better.
Or not.
Anyway, at 20 cents or a quarter, they were an easy risk. Maybe that's why I never got upset about imaginary stories or botched continuity. I was okay not knowing with certainty where Power Girl came from. And I never blew a gasket when Superboy's latest adventure turned out to be a dream or a trick played on him by his Legion buddies. It was only much later that I started to find myself growing impatient with matters of continuity, and that was really only after Crisis on Infinite Earths. Even so, I never understood what the continuity fuss was all about. Did anyone seriously think a new reader was going to be driven away because the Flash of Earth 1 was once seen reading a comic book featuring the Flash of Earth 2? It's comics, not rocket surgery.
Now, I can't speak for readers 20, 25 years ago, but I did see a couple months back during the Flash pilot, someone that I met in college who was watching along and, you know, wasn't super enjoying it, and that's fine, but got about 10 minutes in and just rage quit because Cisco was wearing a Big Bang Theory t-shirt. And just, oh, but on Big Bang Theory, they make reference to Barry Allen, and they know he's the Flash. No, isn't that such a coincidence that there's this other guy, and he's got powers, and he's the Flash? And it's like, really, dude? That's the part that ruins your suspension of disbelief? Not the fact that he got hit by a lightning bolt and can now run faster than the speed of sound? You knew what you were signing up for, right?
Neil ends asking, I wonder if younger fans sometimes have a different relationship with non-continuity stories, because they entered comics fandom only after the trend toward multi-title crossovers and decompressed storytelling was the norm. That kind of storytelling which makes fussy continuity practically indispensable. I can only speculate, of course, but I'd love to know. That is a great question, Neil. Did I mention that Neil teaches college?
Huh.
See, I like guys asking good questions like that. I can respect that.
There is a certain veneer of intellectualism that's all over this email. It's like, huh, yep.
Someone like that raised me.
Huh, is that what you were yeah. Thinking? Huh, I recognize this thought process. Now, we're going to skip over Identity Crisis for now and talk about some feedback that we got for last episode, number 26, all about Superman and Batman. Chris Franklin said, I was very excited to hear Michael Bradley stop by on your show. I'm a big fan of his Superman and Batman show.
So are we, Chris. So are we.
That was really fun. I like whenever we can have people on the show. It's rare because of the type of show that we run, but when it happens, it is awesome.
Yes.
I think the three of you had a very enlightening discussion on the commonalities and differences between the two characters. I personally believe the idea of Superman and Batman instantly at odds with one another is as cliched today as some folks view their chummy relationship from 3 decades ago. I absolutely agree.
That's probably a fair point. In reality, the relationship should probably be somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And we just picked two extremes, decided to live there for a while. And probably better storytelling is somewhere in the nuance.
Yeah. In there where there's actual conflict as well as relationship.
And respect and trust and concerns about each other's.
This is why we like reading our listeners' feedback. They are smart people.
Are you saying you think Cindy wrote this?
I mean, I'm not saying
it just seems like it possibly could have. I'm not judging. I'm just saying it's possible.
I read this Superman Batman annual in a trade from the local library. Always a good decision. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. As much as I love all DC history, well, up to 2011, I do have a soft spot for the perfectly synthesized DCAU, or the Timverse, which includes Batman Beyond. So like Emily, I'm always happy to see Terry included in the regular DC universe.
So are we, on all those counts.
Mm-hmm. Also, I nearly gasped out loud when Emily said she didn't like Batman the Brave and the Bold. I think she might be the first fan I've ever met who didn't love or at least like that show. I'll try not to hold it against her.
Kids these days, Chris. Kids these days. Ugh, that's all I can say.
I know, right? They just don't like fun. I'm not letting that go.
Emily needs to calm down now for a little while, so we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back with comments on episode 25, our identity crisis episode. And we'll do that right after this.
Superman.
Captain Marvel.
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariane.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear
Man. The Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents...
And many, many more.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January only at twotruefreaks.com.
And we're back. And as you may have noticed, there's still about half of an episode to go. And it's all about identity crisis. Gene Hendricks sent us our first email of this section to Alan and Emily. Maybe I'm odd, besides loving Quasar, but I like Identity Crisis. Don't love it, don't hate it, just like it.
I think that does put Gene in a specific, distinct minority. At least that's my impression.
He would be the first person that I know with that opinion. Kudos for having an individual opinion. You go, Gene. I like how everything was handled in the story, from the art to the writing. What I really don't like is the aftermath. The all-new, all-rapey DC comics that came out of it went way too dark for me, but I'm stuck in my 80s, 90s mindset. I think I would have liked the story better as an Elseworlds book, kind of like The Killing Joke was supposed to be. The loss of Sue is, as Emily said, synonymous with the loss of lighthearted storytelling in comics. And I think that that is the real tragedy of the aftermath.
Yeah, that's a good point. I know, I've used as one of my defenses of identity crisis, if you will, the Killing Joke and the fact that violence and potentially sexual violence, depending how you read the Killing Joke, did not come into the DCU with Identity Crisis. It's not that the Silver Age lasted until 2004.
Right. You
know, things had been going that way. Certainly, Identity Crisis was a step up,
yeah,
if you will, or a new plateau from which darker and grittier, quote-unquote, things happened. So I do certainly acknowledge that point.
Yeah. And that was an interesting thing to bring up. The Killing Joke has sort of become canon, to tie this into our earlier discussions, through popular demand / fan approval. But it was supposed to be an Elseworlds story. That's just, I think, something that's important to bring up. That a lot of these stories are sort of meant to be self-contained, individual, solitary stories. But, as with all art, for good and ill, it does not exist in a vacuum.
Right. Kyle Benning, the Metropolis Kid, is the host of the new podcast, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun. He told us that this is one of his all-time favorite stories. I absolutely love Identity Crisis. This book completely blew me away and led me to dive back into the DCU full throttle. I did not have a comic shop in my hometown, so when Diamond took over distribution and comics disappeared from grocery stores, getting my fix was reduced to multi-packs from Walmart and whatever I found at garage sales. That is, until I turned 16 and got a driver's license. Ah, teenage freedom. I found a comic store, and it wasn't long before I was headlong into obsession. And there sat all 7 issues of Identity Crisis on the shelf. Hey, I loved Crisis on Infinite Earths, and this was another DC Crisis book. So I picked it up, and after finishing my Transformers issues, Jason Trenner would be proud, and the recent issues of Captain America, I decided to pick up issue 1 of Identity Crisis as my last read before going to bed.
Now let me just say, I have no idea where this story could possibly be going.
That plan never works.
Nope.
Little did I know, Kyle says, that I'd really be up reading the entire series for another 2 hours.
And weeping into a pillow clutched to your shattered fan heart.
The first issue hooked me, and I couldn't stop reading till I finished. What a fascinating book. Character development, plot twists, mystery, suspense, drama, and superheroes to boot. This comic had it all and was the most compelling story I had ever read, comics or otherwise. My mom was a big fan of Meltzer's novels, so I gave it to her, and she was blown away by it as well.
Now, that's something that's interesting about this book, is that even though it is really dark and deals with some seriously heavy material and has a main cast of about 24, that it's really, really new reader friendly. That you can give this book to almost anyone, and as a self-contained story, it does a good job of explaining the status quo and filling you in and expressing the relationships between all these various different characters and gets you a pretty good feel of the history. This was the first Justice League book that I'd really read,
mm-hmm.
You know, that dealt with not the main 7. So this was one of my first Green Lantern books, and I love Green Lantern. It was the first time I met Firestorm, and I love Firestorm.
Spectre!
Oh my gosh, Hal Jordan Spectre is so good. Like, it's ridiculously good. And this just, it blew my mind. There is something about that a lot of people, this was their first book in a while, or the book that started their DC fandom.
Right. You know, I mean, we've talked about, you know, comics that you can get your girlfriend to read. But a comic you can get your mom to read? Kyle.
Good on you.
I can't say I ever thought about that before. He continues. The story itself is everything that comic readers want. A well-paced, content-heavy story that wraps you up in the character dynamics of these seemingly perfect heroes. It's what so many comics nowadays try to do and fail at. The message and violence are powerful and tasteful. What happens to Sue is despicable. It should bother you. But for some, it just bothers them to the point that they don't want to finish the story. I see where they're coming from, but as you both, I see it as a credit to Meltzer's storytelling skills and as a sign of a truly good story. I can't wait to hear what you cover next. That's great, Kyle. Thanks a lot. And the thing is, it's not just that we got a lot of feedback on this episode. It's that we got a lot of long, thoughtful, and in some cases vulnerable feedback on this episode. Like this note from new feedbacker Bradley Null, aka Bradley Man, faster than a speeding turtle, more powerful than a loco dog, able to leap.
First, a bit about me and the Dibneys. I learned to read during the satellite years. I love the Justice League, but not for the big three. I was a fan of the guys without books. Red Tornado, Firestorm, Zatanna, The Elongated Man. Ralph was tied for my favorite. He was funny, happy, almost as good of a detective as Batman, and had no secret identity. He fascinated me. I even had to look up the word elongated just because of him. When the League moved to Detroit, I stopped buying the book, but read my friend Danny's copies to keep tabs on the only two characters in the book that I still cared about, the Dibneys. I was thrilled when Justice League Europe number 1 had the Elongated Man on its cover. I started reading the Wally West version of The Flash because of the way Wally talked to Ralph. I also loved that Sue became an important part of the JLE. I bought every issue of every mini they were in. Ralph may only be 10th or so on my favorite hero list, but the Dibneys come in just ahead of Reed and Sue for favorite super couple. Apparently, smart stretchy man always have to be married to girls named Sue.
First of all, that is an amazingly insightful comment. And I checked. Sue Dibney debuted in Flash 119, cover dated March 1961. Sue Storm debuted in FF number 1, dated 8 months later. But I love super stretchy guys always
married girls named Sue.
That is something.
When I saw Identity Crisis number 1 on the shelves, I was convinced Kyle Rayner, a.k.a. character I had been taking heat for liking, was in the coffin. I knew there were plans to unkill that annoying flyboy who was way better as the Spectre anyway, Hal Jordan, and I assumed that this was the major event that would eliminate the current GL. Kyle's not on the cover, and it was a safe, if incorrect, assumption. Then I read the book. It was the first time a superhero comic actually made me cry. Ralph telling the secret origin of his and Sue's love, the humorous Ollie is going bald moment, the birthday mystery established in Justice League Quarterly, all this everyday stuff, and then bam! Ralph's too late, Sue is dead, and I'm unable to turn the page. I have no idea how long it took to finally move on. I remember calling my buddy Danny before I finished the comic. He'd already finished it and told me to keep going. Then the funeral. Every moment of it was tear-filled for me. It was perfect, right down to Ralph falling apart at the end. The wait what ending of issue 1, where Dr. Light is revealed as the main suspect, was extremely puzzling. Waiting for each issue to come out after that was maddening. I love this series, and it's part of why I wait for the trades now. I've just got to have the next chapter.
Yeah, I cannot comprehend what that wait must have been like. There's something about reading those stories monthly that I guess as a kid maybe is exciting, but whether it's I'm just become so impatient as an adult,
That just sounds maddening. Maddening. And especially for one like this, like, you know,
because it's a mystery story as much as anything else, and there's that whodunit aspect to it.
This really is a graphic novel. We've said this before, sort of the difference between a trade and a graphic novel.
Right.
Even though it is broken up into sections, the sections, like part 1, part 2, etc. of a novel, not like subsequent novels in a series.
Right.
I can't even comprehend what that 4 weeks must have been like. I'm guessing torturous.
I would say so.
The idea that they had mind-wiped Batman was dizzying. I spent 4 weeks convinced that Ray Palmer was the killer, which only lasts a page turn now. And the theories as to why he'd snapped were the conversations over at least 3 Denny's meals, which is the proper way to measure these sorts of things.
You know, the comparison would be to, say, binge watching a TV show versus watching individual episodes.
But even then, that's a 7-day wait.
Exactly. To me, it's fun waiting a week for the next Flash episode. Again, a month is a long, long time to kick around these theories and try to figure out what's going on and who's next. That just... I do not have the patience anymore for that.
Yeah. When it turned out that the killer was Jean, not Ray, well, it actually made more sense than anything that we had come up with. I still have the original issues and love this series. A note on Jean and her madness. Find some of the old Super Team Family comics from the 70s, where the Atom chases his crazy, sometimes dangerously powered wife, and Arkham really does seem the appropriate choice. To be fair,
yeah,
that does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Maybe that didn't come as out of the blue as we had thought.
Yeah, because then again, we are clearly not as big fans of 1970s DC as Brad Meltzer. A note on the rape. I have a friend who was raped. Let's call her Jen. When she read online about the retcon rape, Jen was furious. She told me it was making light of things that shouldn't be swept away. Then she read the book. Ralph's reaction to the rape and his unwavering support of his wife should be shown to the husbands of all rape victims. Those are Jen's words, not mine, from the email she sent just after she'd finished reading Identity Crisis. And I'm tearing up a little bit just thinking about it.
Wow. Bradley Null, for a first feedback to the show, this one was a doozy. I mean, just, wow. Thanks, thanks for sharing is, I think, all we can say.
There's really nothing to add.
You know, I do think that one thing we may have accomplished with this episode was giving a place for fans of this story to come out of the closet, as it were. As fans of the story, because, you know, I've seen people criticized and derided online simply for liking this comic book. We were hesitant to put out our positive thoughts on the issue until we had been at this for 25 episodes. We, you know, I seriously felt we needed to have a store of goodwill built up, you know, just in case, just because some of the comments I've seen directed not just at the story, but at people who like the story. So if we've made a little safe place here for folks like us or Kyle or Bradley and others to admit how affecting this story is, then maybe that's something we've accomplished.
Yeah. And the majority of our feedback for this is certainly positive. People certainly enjoyed our episode talking about Identity Crisis, even if they in some cases disagreed with us or even just had a different opinion of the story. So I've really appreciated how intelligent and respectful and heartfelt our feedback has been.
So we have seen comments and responses to Identity Crisis that
were not
respectful or and thought out. Or
That could be just the vast majority of our listeners also really liked the story, or the people who have less positive feelings about it chose not to show up and harsh the mood, which in either case, I actually do appreciate. If you do have, you know, negative feelings about the story and you do have something to say about it, you can totally email us. We'll probably keep talking about this for a while because it's a doozy of a story.
Mm-hmm. But we appreciate, again, as you've heard, we have more coming up, just the real thought that
yeah.
Listeners have put into their feedback for this particular episode.
So I've appreciated everyone following the if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything rule, which is wonderful and does not happen often on the internet. So kudos to you guys for being awesome.
Our friend and possible weather-based villainous nemesis, Kurt Green, also wrote in. I was not a DCU fan when this came out, but a friend suggested it, saying it was a really good murder mystery. So I picked up the first four issues and was thoroughly engrossed. I didn't guess the ending, but loved the conditioning on Dr. Light, the ethical issues, the mind-wiping, and the twist at the end of issue 6 really kept me guessing. I wrote Brad Meltzer about how much I enjoyed this, and he still sends me occasional mass emails about what he's working on, his latest books, and his History Channel projects.
Excellent! Noel Thingvall also had some comments for this episode. I need to dig out Identity Crisis for a fresh read, but I was really blown away by it the first time I read it. I just started getting heavily into comics again and was dipping my toes into DC when the series ran. And as I knew my dad was a fan of Meltzer's novels, and I enjoyed his Green Arrow work, I figured I'd give it a go. This was my first time ever reading a lot of these DC characters, many of whom I'd never even heard of. On top of which was them being thrown into a complex, challenging story about ethics, choices, and consequences. After this, I dove pretty heavily into DC for the next couple of years before rising up for air eventually.
Now, there is an interesting through line, but it seems that people who are more likely to like Identity Crisis were people not entrenched in the DCU of that era. And that's you and me.
Mm-hmm.
That's Noel, that's Kyle Bending, that's Bradley Null. While those who were more invested in the DCU at the time, I think, find it much more problematic for continuity reasons
and what
it did to their universe.
Right.
Now, I think this is probably going to help raise the book's reputation over the years, because new people coming to it, by definition, will be people who are not entrenched in the DCU of 2005.
I disagree. I think it's a great story, and I appreciate people talking a little bit more about its finer points, but I don't think that this story is ever going to reach what I think is probably its rightful heights of being recognized as a seminal DC story of the early 2000s, of being the killing joke of the millennial decade. I doubt that's ever going to happen, because the further away from the time that we get, people are not going to remember the climate the story was written in. The general continuity has been changed and rewritten a couple times since then.
Right.
People won't be coming to this from that fresh, even your fresh version of the DC universe. In 2005, you're like fresh awareness of what's going on.
Right.
You know, you had the DC animated TV show, which actually has a lot of the same characters and has a similar sort of semi-satellite modern aesthetic. Whereas today, all people are going to remember from like this point going forward is the controversy. That is just going to overshadow
I can see that.
Everything that's in the actual stories. And then, of course, all of the subsequent things that followed after it, that it's going to be tied to. I am not hopeful for new readers finding this.
How about if I rephrase my statement and say, I hope that distance will help raise the book's reputation.
I certainly hope it happens.
But you are less hopeful than I am.
I am very pessimistic about its chances. I've been trying to sell it to 3 or 4 people. Let me say, the Kents is an infinitely easier sell.
Because the Kents, they haven't heard of. They have no baggage going into it. Identity Crisis, you mention it. If people of your generation have heard of it, they've heard of it in the context of darkness, rape, mind wipe.
Murder, violence, hatred towards women. Fridging. Like, that's all they hear. When I say, I love Identity Crisis, the first word out of their mouth is the one with the rape. Oh, I heard it's full of fridging. I can't believe anyone likes that. It's so dark. I thought you liked fun books. I thought you had better taste. I've been told that. I thought you had better taste in comics because you like Identity Crisis. I'm like, I have great taste in comics.
I thought you were more sensitive than that. I thought you were a better feminist than that.
Yeah, that's the other one.
Yeah. Interesting.
I hope that people can recognize it for the great story that it is.
Right.
I really, really hope they can. Noel continues, I wonder how much of the backlash is due to a general distaste with tragedy that I've seen in fandoms recently, where fanons, fanfic, fan art have led people to almost bubbling themselves from anything that hurts or negatively portrays the characters they love. Me? I like it when a hero is forced to deal with their choices, or to face consequences, or fail, or find themselves at ethical odds with one another. We can debate execution, but I like the idea of Superman having to kill Zod, or Cyclops flipping sides, or Green Lantern going so bad that all of his friends have to put him down, and he's left struggling with what he's done as he continues in the afterlife as the Spirit of Vengeance.
Which is a great story,
Which
Michael.
Is such a good story. For anyone who doesn't like Identity Crisis, you should still read that, because, oh my god, is the Spectre amazing. Again, easier sell than Identity Crisis. I've gotten one of my people to read Spectre books. Hopefully, I'll be able to convince him to read Identity Crisis because the Spectre's in it. I like it when heroes not only become human, but mess up in spectacularly human ways and have to deal with the fallout of their choices.
Now, this is an interesting idea, this idea of so identifying with the characters in your fandom that you don't want bad things to ever happen to them. That was just a take that I'd never thought of. I consider myself a fan in the general sense, but not really part of any particular fandom, quote-unquote. And I think because of that, I probably miss out on some emotional highs that come from that close identification with the property, being part of a community that supports that character or that franchise. But I also probably miss out on the emotional lows that come from that, from being part of fandom. I thought that was a really interesting take.
You were not a Batwoman fan who just had her book shifted around to four different people and canceled. Like, you didn't have to go through that pain.
It bummed us out when All-Star Western and before that, Demon Knights were canceled.
I'm still sad about Demon Knights.
But I don't think you were
crushed.
Emotionally hurt, crushed, angry.
Bitter.
I think,
yeah,
there's a difference with some parts of fandom, which I thought that he put it really interestingly.
Yeah. This point about distaste with tragedy, I thought was a great insight. I'm not quite sure how I want to attribute or discuss or whatever, but Noel is absolutely on point here, that I have seen a rising distaste with tragedy, largely because hopeful, happy, fun books have become kind of few and far between. Hopefully, again, we're hopeful about the future of comics, that there will be more positive, happy, fun books. But it means people are burnt out on the concept of darkness, which they associate with literary tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an unfortunate thing, and I wish fewer people did this. Because you can have a wonderful, fantastic tragedy that also has a lot of comedy in it. Case in point, Identity Crisis Issue 1. I want us to be at a place where that can happen, and people not feel hurt by it, because there are more fun, happy stories that you can choose from.
I wonder if there's something bigger, something societal even, happening here. We know historically that the types of horror movies that are popular changes over time with some connection to what's going on politically,
and
socially, and economically.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if 6-7 years of economic malaise, including folks in your generation getting out of college with more debt than they have in salary, leave folks looking for positive things, wanting positive things. I think we could say two words, The Flash.
Yeah.
And see, I think there's a
reason.
For
all that you said that you're not a strong fan connected with really emotional highs and lows of a particular property. Oh my gosh, The Flash.
But I think that's one reason why it's not that the fandom is so much huger than the fandom for Arrow or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or some of the other shows. Its ratings are not or not, you know, 3, 4, 5 times that. But the engagement, the passion among those fans is very strong. And I wonder if part of it is people in a economic and social time of turbulence and change and stress and struggle find something happy and light to identify with. And so when that's taken away, it hurts even more.
Yeah. Which, again, is not to say that Flash doesn't have substance or darkness or tragedy, okay? Murdered mother, falsely imprisoned father. Like, he's 75% of the way to having Batman's
backstory.
Right. But in the words of Oliver Queen, I guess I'm just not as emotionally healthy as you are. To be able to have bad things happen and to rise above them, to meet them with humor, to still find hope in those sorts of situations is just so uplifting. And I'm glad we're getting it in our DC-licensed TV shows. But if the TV properties are getting better, it gives me some hope for the comics.
Right. Again, I think there's a reason something like Guardians of the Galaxy resonates.
Yes.
Or the Avengers resonate. Because, I mean, those are tough stories with tough characters. But there is just a light touch to them. There's enough humor in them that makes them attractive. And I think that's, again, part of why people are so passionate about those properties.
Back to Noel. It should be remembered that this was a prequel event to Infinite Crisis and did cross over with and nudge forward a bunch of books. So like any event, Meltzer had some editorial mandates that he needed to work in. As for Firestorm, what happened there actually made me read the new Firestorm book that followed, which quickly became one of my new favorites. I do agree with Emily that one of the problems of choosing Dr. Light is that it retroactively colors those past appearances, and a lesser character wouldn't have suffered the same fate. Also, the Dr. Light appearances following Identity, mostly in Teen Titans, were really not well handled. But for my money, I think it's an important story, a very smart story, and a challenging story, a very well executed and very hard story. So I can definitely understand why it had the controversial legacy that it does. And yeah, Ralph at the Funeral hits me every time.
Me too.
And at last, we reach our final piece of feedback from Podcasting's own Michael Bailey, who sent us another one of his excellent editorial novellas.
It was refreshing to hear two people talk about this story from a positive perspective. Not that people haven't said good things about it in the past. When I covered it with Stella on an episode of Views, I was mostly positive because there are large chunks of the story that I like. My problem is that it's hard for me to separate what that story is from what that story's become. What I liked about the coverage is that you took the story as a standalone piece, but, sigh, the story was the beginning of a pretty dark period for the company, and I say that as someone that was 17 kinds of excited for the build-up and release of Infinite Crisis, and Identity Crisis was one of the major kickoffs to that.
I really wanted to talk about this because we even a vast amount avoided mentioning it in the episode we actually did about Identity Crisis because we wanted that to stay mostly positive. And because we also thought it was kind of unfair to judge a book by what followed. I can see people pointing to Identity Crisis and saying that it was what started the negative, gritty, grim, angry, bitter, dark DC universe. But what came out immediately afterwards was Infinite Crisis, and following that, 52.
Which were both awesome.
Awesome! And, you know, maybe a little on the darker side, maybe a little bit more serious, or a touch more violent than they'd been before, but still, really well-written and engaging stories about minor characters, basically doing for The Question and Booster Gold what Identity Crisis did for The Elongated Man, making them relevant and important and part of an ongoing series. And that's fantastic.
I think it's what followed those.
That's
the problem.
Yeah, so because after 52 was Countdown. And then following that, Final Crisis. Now, Final Crisis is Morrison, so it's Morrison-y.
It's often its own
It's its own
world.
Thing. But I will say, I totally understand people who can't read Identity Crisis because of what it's connected to in their minds. Because I will probably never read Final Crisis. Not because it's Morrison, but because it was preceded by friggin' Countdown, and I hate that book with almost every fiber of my being. And it's not fair to judge a book by what it's connected to, except that these are serialized stories.
And we all do this.
We all do this. This is kind of the point. This is why we read comics, is to read one ongoing 50-year, 30-year, 26-year narrative that is broken up into 400 chapters. To have your Game of Thrones released to you 23 pages at a time, it builds this sweeping epic. So maybe it's not fair, but it totally happens, and I get where people are coming from. I really do.
Mike continues, this story set the tone for what was to come, and that meant more grittiness and more violence. Yes, I know bad things happen, and I can't look at my entertainment and say, go on, challenge me, and then follow that up with, hey, just don't get too icky, okay? Rape is a very real thing, and I know the stories that I read and watch might touch on it, but it seemed like it has since become a trope almost, and just not a serious topic to be discussed. He then said that being a rapist became Dr. Light's defining characteristic, which Mike found distasteful. By all means, discuss serious issues, but don't use Light as super rapist. And don't, for example, have him kidnap several women, dress them up as members of the Teen Titans, and then do horrible things to them.
This is why I just choose to ignore this entire section of following comics, because they are terrible. This is the problem with the ongoing story. We love the ongoing stories, except when they are poorly handled, written by idiots, insensitive, poorly plotted, nonsensical. There was a chance for rape and sexual violence to be discussed in a genuinely mature and still horrifying but sensitive way. And they botched it.
It is safe to say that in the last 10 years, that has not happened.
Yeah.
10 years later, that's not what's happening, unfortunately.
Yeah. I made reference to Batwoman just a little while ago.
Right.
Part of what got it canceled was a combination of people dropping from the book like flies, them attempting to do something shocking, introducing excessive and frequent sexual violence, and everybody leaving at once. Michael is totally on point that it has become a shortcut rather than an actual issue to be discussed. And that is, frankly, disgusting. And it makes me sad. Because what I see when I read Identity Crisis is so much opportunity. Mm-hmm. So much opportunity for Ralph Dibny to be a vital part of the universe. For Ray Palmer to be relevant again. For all of these sorts of really difficult but interesting discussions about ethics. For a really rather brutal but honest and heartfelt and strangely sensitive discussion of sexual violence, which is becoming increasingly common in our world, and then just utterly being mishandled. So much opportunity,
right,
and so little of it coming to fruition.
And that colors your view of what happened after Identity Crisis, but not of the book itself.
Right. I try very hard to keep the two separate, because unlike the people writing Light as Dr. Super Rapist, Brad Meltzer is a good writer who cares about things like character arcs and motivation.
Mike continues agreeing with you on the Jack Drake plotline, saying that it came at a really odd time. A few months before this, Jack discovered that Tim was Robin and did what any reasonable father would do. He went to Wayne Manor and pulled a gun on Bruce.
To be fair, I probably would have done the same thing.
Yes. Tim voluntarily gave up being Robin, which paved the way for Stephanie Brown to take on that role for a few months before she was fired.
Lame.
So yeah, identity crisis. It is a weird kettle of fish. I enjoyed the story, even though I loved Sue Dibney and Ralph and the other characters that were killed or worse. Conversely, I'll never forgive them for killing Jack Drake because him being alive made Tim a very unique Robin. I go back and forth and back and forth and can never come to a conclusion. As something in and of itself, sometimes I think it's magnificent. As part of a fictional universe that I was following closely at the time, it's much more problematic. In any case, you did a wonderful job breaking it down.
Thank you, Michael. We did our best, and I think, judging from the feedback we've gotten, our best was pretty good.
And again, I think Mike hits that distinction between people who were in the DCU at the time, as he was, who has these mixed feelings about it, as opposed to us being more tilted towards the positive, not having that baggage, if you will, mm-hmm. dragging us down. But I absolutely loved Mike's email here. This is a story that Michael has been wrestling with for nearly 10 years. 10 years out, and he can't quite decide if he likes it, loves it, hates it. Not to put words in his mouth, but it seems like it's all of those things. None of them and all of them at the same time. And he's still conflicted about how he feels about it. And again, in and of itself, I say that counts as well done, Brad Meltzer, if you're still wrestling with it a decade later.
That is a sign of art. Well done.
I think so.
Difficult and wonderful and horrible and confusing and conflicting and disturbing and heartfelt. And
it does generate emotional responses.
And a variety of them.
I was going to say, on the internet, we tend to see one type of emotional response. And in some of this earlier feedback, we saw a different type of emotional response. Much of it involving grown men crying.
Yes. There's a lot of that. But yeah, I think that pretty thoroughly wraps up Identity Crisis. So, we have finally reached the end. And not to turn this whole feedback thing into a schmaltzy-faltzy love and hug fest, but it was pretty fantastic. The amount of support and positive responses that we've had on this show in the last couple months, and for the last year and a half. We were pleased and surprised and weirdly proud of the quality and number of email responses that were generated by these topics.
Yeah, I mean, and just more appreciative than we can say.
Yeah. This show is all about conversation. And conversation between two people, yeah, that's pretty good. Conversation between 15 people. Significantly better. So I guess, if you have feedback on the feedback, or any of our other episodes, you can send us feedback at relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or by doing what Noel does, commenting on the posts on the website at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
We're going to get out one more episode before the end of 2014, but this one is scheduled for release a few days before Christmas, and I know that not everyone in the listener base either celebrates that holiday or observes it in the same way, but we are going to close this episode out with a Christmas song, and the song is a darkly electronic version of O Come, O Come, Emmanuel by musician and podcaster Peter Franzen, from the Spirit Blade Underground. Again, we just want to wish you a joyous holiday, Merry Christmas, season's greetings, and really,
thanks for listening.
Didst give the law. in cloud and majesty and awe.
Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O
near to you today, if you'll only ask him.